The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Before I introduce our guest speaker, I'd like to recognize, we have lots of distinguished guests, but I'd like to recognize one of them in particular, Judge Barbara Rothstein from the Western District of Washington, who is currently the director of the Federal Judicial Center. John, you can sit next to Lisa if you'd like her. Well, it's my privilege to introduce our lunch speaker today. I think there's no one in the federal judiciary who is better qualified to speak to us today because Judge Brinkema has presided over the biggest and most difficult terrorist case since 9/11. Biggest because the government was intent on a show trial presenting the fruits of the largest criminal investigation by the FBI in history, the investigation of the 9/11 plot. The most difficult because the defendant insisted, at least most of the time, on representing himself, and he wanted and was entitled to access to testimony by some of the top Al-Qaeda detainees, the so-called high-value detainees. I think their names are redacted in the F-second, but it's widely rumored to include Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Bin Al-Shi. Judge Brinkema conducted these lengthy and difficult proceedings with amazing skill, integrity, and courage. The first example of her courage was ordering videotaped depositions of these high-level detainees, video depositions by the defendant's lawyers. When the government refused to comply with Judge Brinkema's order, it invited her to dismiss the case so it could appeal to the Fourth Circuit and take its chances on getting her reversed. Judge Brinkema did not rise to the bait. Instead, she issued another courageous decision, imposing sanctions on the government for refusing to comply with the order for videotape depositions. The sanctions, you may recall, were excluding the evidence of Moussaoui's participation in the 9/11 plot itself. You may recall that initially, I think at the time of 9/11, he was suspected of being the 20th hijacker. One of the things we found out in the 9/11 Commission investigation in which I was involved was that he probably wasn't and somebody else was. In any event, the sanction was the government could not introduce evidence relating to Moussaoui's participation or knowledge of the 9/11 plot, and that it could no longer seek the death penalty. The government appealed, and the Fourth Circuit, while it reversed and sent the case back to Judge Moussaoui, we'll put that in the Guinness Book of Records for Freudian slips. Sent it back to Judge Brinkema, directing her to, they basically upheld her on the law in terms of what of Moussaoui's entitlement to access to the high-level detainees. But it directed her to fashion a different remedy in lieu of the sanctions she had imposed, to allow the government to prepare so-called substitutions consisting of unclassified summaries of the relevant portions of the intelligence reports on the interrogations of these detainees that would then be made available to the defendant and introduced into evidence at the trial. The process, much I think to the government's relief, was cut short, maybe to Judge Brinkema's relief too, but I won't ask her to comment on that, by Moussaoui deciding to plead guilty. Judge Brinkema then presided over one of the lengthiest sentencing hearings of all time, I think, that really was a mini trial and that led to Moussaoui's life sentence. Moussaoui is trying to undo his guilty plea. He filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea, which Judge Brinkema denied. That is now under appeal in the Fourth Circuit. Judge Brinkema reminded me that she has also been a judge in other terrorist cases, most notably the Al-Tamimi case, in which a Muslim cleric in Virginia was convicted of supporting terrorism by urging his followers after 9/11 to go to Afghanistan to be trained to fight against Americans. A brief biography of Judge Brinkema, it's in your materials. She is a veteran prosecutor, both in the criminal division at Maine Justice and in the Eastern District of Virginia. She then became a magistrate judge, and in 1993, she was appointed to the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. It's a privilege to hear from Judge Brinkema.
I hope you all can hear me. I've been fighting off a cold, so if you can't, you know, raise your hand, and please go ahead and eat. We are moving this along. Can you hear me in the corner? Yes? Okay. We're moving this along because, as most of you know, I come from the Eastern District of Virginia, known throughout the world as the Rocket Docket. And one of the ways you maintain a rocket docket is by really worshiping the clock. So we're starting late. I've been asked to try to finish my comments by about 1:45, so there'll still be some time for questions, and that will keep the afternoon from getting badly messed up in terms of schedule. I also wanted to just, am I getting an echo?
Yeah.
Okay. Too much. I also wanted to just amplify a little bit on what Professor Marcus said, and this is not as a boast. It's simply meant to give you an understanding of the background from which I speak. I think I may be the judge in the country who has had the most, and if not the most, just about the most terrorist cases that have been brought into the criminal justice system. Because in addition to Moussaoui and the Tamimi case, Tamimi was one of about 15 people who were tried as part of, depending upon how you viewed the case, the Virginia paintball case or the Virginia jihad case. But it resulted in numerous both jury and bench trials and guilty pleas, and I handled two of the bench trials, one of the jury trials, and a bunch of the pleas. But even in addition to that, while Moussaoui was still pending, I also handled the guilty plea of Imam Faris. And so I've had a lot of exposure with these cases, and those exposures are what inform my position on the issue to which I'm going to speak today. I know that the whole program is focused on how we as lawyers and judges and as a country respond to the threat of terrorism through our legal institutions, and whether the current institutions are sufficient to wage this battle or whether we need to have new programs, new systems put into place. And as a disclaimer, I should tell you from the outset that I probably completely agree with Judge Wall and everything she said. And that is, I am absolutely convinced from my personal experience that the current criminal justice system can adequately, with some tinkering, adequately address terrorist cases. So I am going to answer the question, can the system do it? I think clearly it can. Should the system do it, which perhaps is the more interesting question, I would still say yes, again, with some caveats. And obviously those are issues that you all are going to be talking about throughout the rest of the day. But the particular value that I guess I can add to this discussion is to talk to you from a very pragmatic point of view. I don't have the academic ivory tower approach. I'm not in a think tank. I haven't been a soldier on the battlefield. I haven't been a politician on the dais making arguments for or against certain policies. I've simply been a trial judge in the courtroom working on these cases since December of 2001. And based on that experience, I've reached the conclusion that the system, in fact, does work. And I will say, and I always take it personally, I'm very annoyed when people talk about how difficult the Moussaoui case was or how messy it was or that it was a circus. Because it wasn't. I think it was a good, solid, old-fashioned criminal trial, and it had all the elements of a criminal trial. In fact, I usually talk about the Massawi case as the perfect case, not because I did such a great job, but the case itself was perfect. Much the way some of you may have read the book The Perfect Storm or seen the George Clooney movie made about the book, and you know that it chronicled two major North Atlantic storms that actually came together and formed one perfect storm. The word perfect in some meanings meaning complete. Well, the Massawi case was a complete or perfect trial in the sense that it brought together every complicating element that most experienced trial judges at some point in their lives hit, sometimes in some combination, but not normally all together. It was a pro se defendant charged with very serious acts of violence, in this case, terrorism. It involved the death penalty, which, as any judge or lawyer knows, always significantly complicates things, everything from jury selection to how you try the case. It involved extensive classified information. And I'm going to focus a great deal on that aspect of the case. But just to say from the outset that that's not anything all that unusual. In my court in the Eastern District of Virginia, I can say that since I went on the bench as a district judge, I've never had a year when I haven't had at least one case involving classified information. It's not that unusual for trial judges to have to deal with classified information. My colleague Tim Ellis is dealing with the Rosen case right now and has had days, if not weeks, of SEPA hearings. So there's nothing that a terrorism case has that's that unusual, but for any kind of case that has classified information in it, it's going to be a more complicated case. Now, we did have extraordinary security concerns in the Massawi case. And those concerns were twofold. We were concerned because we didn't really know what Al-Qaeda or sympathizers might want to do with the trial. And we were also, frankly, concerned about the general public. There was very strong feelings about September 11th, rightly so. And there were concerns about would any victims or family members or friends of victims want to act out against Massawi or to do something. So we were worried in those directions. But again, judges who try gang cases, MS-13 cases, have the same types of demands made upon them in terms of worrying about maintaining the integrity of the proceedings, making sure that the participants are safe, that the proceedings don't degenerate into some sort of a horrible, violent event. And this experience has been shared by judges throughout the country for years and years and years. Now, there were thousands of victims of this particular case, and that's a little bit unusual for the average criminal case. But in the Oklahoma City bombing case, Judge McVeigh was faced with a case where there were hundreds of victims, either people who had been injured, who had family members who had died or had been injured, or just people who saw buildings in their city blown up. So again, in mass tort cases, judges have had experience with cases involving thousands of victims who have very strong feelings about the case. There was intense national and international media interest. Well, we all know from all the Britney Spears and other types of cases around here, you know, American public loves cases that have some kind of special notoriety to them, and judges have had to learn to put up with that kind of intense pressure. The Massawi case is still touted as having been the most extensive criminal investigation in U.S. history, and the case itself, when I last looked, which is over a year ago, the file documents in the Massawi case as of August of 2006 were almost 1,900. And there have been things filed since, so it's probably well over 1,900 filed pleadings. And that doesn't include hundreds of letters, memos, and other things that are not actually docketed but are in the case file. So the Massawi case brought all these components together in one case. And what I'm saying, it's very simplistic, is every one of those components by itself or in some types of combinations have been experienced by other judges and have been handled. So it can be done. Now, some of the things, because in the panel this morning, some people mentioned that, you know, I would talk about some of the logistical things that I did, and I thought, since we're talking about terrorism cases, the specific logistical demands that I would focus on were the handling of classified information, and in particular, this confrontation issue that was raised by Massawi wanting to have access to the enemy combatant witnesses. There is no question that dealing with cases involving classified information does present an Article III judge with a unique challenge. And the unique challenge is a challenge of balancing. Now, balancing itself, just as an abstract concept, is fundamental to what judges do every day, and it's frankly fundamental to our entire system of government. The whole concept of checks and balances, if we think about it, is a concept of a constant state of disequilibrium. And that's what truly energizes our country, and it energizes our legal system. With most evidentiary rulings that a judge has to make, what are you doing? You're weighing the probative value of a piece of evidence against any prejudice that that piece of evidence might have. Well, when you're dealing with national security information in a trial, you're doing the same kind of thing. Under the Classified Information Procedures Act, which we all know as CIPA, what is a judge supposed to do when there's a piece of information that the parties are starting to talk about, and the government is saying, this is classified information, and to reveal it will do harm to the national security, and you have a defense attorney saying, I can't represent my client if I don't have access to this information, and in some cases, and the ability to discuss the information with my client. That's what we're often presented with, not just in terrorism cases, but in any espionage case. And in some cases, cases not even involving espionage. This can come up in civil cases, too, if you're dealing with government contractors suing the U.S. government over something to do with some high-tech stuff in Iraq. You can get into CIPA issues in those types of litigations as well. And so the court has to balance. Now, in some cases, you have to balance more than in other cases. And in the Massawi case, of course, we had to balance a lot of information. The crazy thing about the Massawi case, though, was not so much documentary evidence. It was people. I think the Massawi case may have been the first case, and the academic experts can correct me if I'm wrong, where human beings became classified. And that really got strange. We had Massawi and his attorney asking for access. They wanted to speak with certain people who Massawi was telling his lawyers would be able to give them information that would, by the time we got to all this, would be classic mitigation evidence in a death case. And because this was a death case, he had a right to that. Now, as a quick aside, because I think this is a point worth thinking about, and it was not discussed, I don't think, in any respect in the first panel. One of the other players in the war on terrorism, unfortunately, is politics. The war on terror is also a very important piece of political leverage. And the proof of that, in my view, is the fact that decisions were made about the Massawi case, which I thought clearly ran against the national interest. Massawi could have been prosecuted at a non-capital level and not exposed the government to the need to disclose classified information. But I am satisfied in my own mind that for political reasons, for the need to look strong on the war on terrorism, the decision was made to pursue doggedly the death penalty, thereby forcing the courts to have to deal with the mitigation evidence to which this man had a right. If the decision had been made to simply prosecute him for an offense exposing him to life imprisonment, the rules would have been somewhat different, and that risk of exposure would not have been there. And so as you think about separate courts and all this, don't lose sight of the political reality. And I want to just step aside for one more moment to explain why I think this is so troublesome for people who are trying to do the job by the rules. In around 2003, I took a plea from Imam Faris. Mr. Faris was a Pakistani-born, naturalized U.S. citizen, a truck driver from Ohio, whom the FBI had picked up and had started debriefing, and had finally worked out a pre-indictment plea where he was going to plead to a 20-year exposure for assisting terrorists. The plea was completely sealed. We took it around 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. There's almost no one in the courthouse at that hour, and nobody knew about it. My staff was sworn to secrecy, and we took the plea. And in the statement of facts, Faris admitted to being a member of Al-Qaeda in the United States. His job was to be casing locations for a possible second hit, that he had looked at the Brooklyn Bridge, he had looked at The potential for using large trucks in under tunnels, like the tunnel under Baltimore, and exploding them, and he pled guilty to that. I got a call that next morning, Saturday morning, from the U.S. Attorney's Office alerting me that this highly secret, very, very sensitive plea was going to be on the front page of the Washington Post. It had been leaked. And the only possible motive for leaking that case was because it was a fantastic victory in the war on terrorism. It showed that the government had done something. We had caught red-handed on our soil a future terrorist. I was absolutely appalled by that. That leak never was developed. I mean, we never found out who did it. But it was out there. And as a result, Farris clammed up. He lost confidence in his lawyer. He lost confidence in the legal system, in his handlers. Ultimately, he moved to withdraw his guilty plea, which I denied and was affirmed on the Fourth Circuit. So that case is now over. But it was really upsetting. And that happened throughout the Massawi case as well, that we would have a secret hearing, classified information, and the next day there'd be some version of it out in the press. So this issue that's raised about there's classified information in these cases, and that somehow means that we can't try them in the traditional criminal justice model, is something you have to look at very, very skeptically. You also have to look at, I think, very skeptically, what is classified information. And that's an area in the whole system that's very, very problematic. Judges such as myself, and for good reasons, have no ability to truly evaluate what is and is not or should or should not be classified. At the same time, there's almost no review process. And as a result, once some bureaucrat stamps classified on a document, you have incredible problems. Now, what I spent a fair amount of time doing behind the scenes was literally digging my heels in and fighting with the government that certain information simply had to be declassified or classified at a lower level so that at least some of it could go to defense counsel, some of it could go to the trial, some of it could go to even Mr. Massawi, because otherwise it was going to be a complete farce. And most of the time, with some steady pressure, we worked those things out. There was compromise all over the place. But anyway, those are the types of problems that the Massawi case raised, but they were basically solvable. Now, the issue about the enemy combatants and access to them, as I started to say, was a fascinating issue, because we had Massawi faced with the death penalty, arguing that these people would clearly be strong mitigating evidence, in that they would come on the stand and say that Massawi was a bit player, didn't know about September 11th. The date, September 11th, had not been chosen before Massawi was arrested. He was arrested on August 16th of 2001. They hadn't decided at that date when the attack was going to occur. So he could not have known of the actual date of the attack. Now, did he know about Al-Qaeda sending people here to learn how to fly planes, to use them as weapons of mass destruction? That evidence is pretty strongly there. And given the broad reach of conspiracy law, that's really enough, given the overt acts he engaged in. But the point is that whether or not that's enough to result in the death penalty, and whether he had a right to the mitigating evidence from the very people who planned this thing to say this guy was just, you know, fruitcake. We had him here and then we cut him off because he wouldn't follow directions, was something he had a legitimate right to because the death penalty had stayed on the agenda. And so we had this. I had this problem of what do I do with these witnesses whom he wants access to, and he'd made a very strong, colorable showing that they had relevant information about him. And Professor Marcus has described quite accurately the sort of the process that we went through with the Fourth Circuit. But what we wound up doing is when it came back, and I was directed to work out summaries of what these witnesses had said, again, doing the balancing act, the way I worked it out was I let the defense counsel choose every statement that was favorable to their position and gave the government very little favorable stuff, since there wasn't going to be an ability to cross-examine these witnesses. It was so much disfavoring the defendant, I felt my job was to even up the playing field. And so we wound up giving these summarized statements to the jury, as actual exhibits. Now, you know, again, in trials, you very seldom will send the testimony of a particular witness to the jury, because that would be focusing on that particular witness's testimony. But in this case, because Ms. Sawi did not have the ability to bring these witnesses into court and to have them subject to the normal ability of the jury to see their demeanor and listen to their tone of voice, etc., the way I felt we could even up that disadvantage was to say to the jury, all right, here's the statement of Ramzi Ben-Al-Sheib. This is what he would have said had he come into court and testified. And then each one of those written statements, we had a preamble explaining basically text from the Fourth Circuit opinion that the jury was to review that testimony as having been made under indicia of reliability, because the Fourth Circuit made the conclusion that the incentive of the interrogators of these people was to get the truth, and therefore they felt that that was sufficient indicia of reliability that those statements could come in without the ability to test them through cross-examination. And that's how that testimony went to the jury in that rather strange fashion. I'm not convinced that that's a totally unfair way of doing it. It's not ideal. The more ideal thing, and frankly, I don't see why this can't be done, is the use of Rule 15 depositions. Now, we did have a Rule 15 deposition in the Musawi case. There was a member of one of the Indonesian radical groups who'd been arrested and was being held outside of Jakarta, and he had relevant information that both sides wanted. And what we did in that case is we sent a team of the prosecuting team and defense counsel, Frank Dunham was the defense attorney at that point, to the prison in Indonesia. I was in my courtroom with Mr. Musawi, other prosecutors, and other defense counsel, my court reporter. We had a video link so that we were able to see the witness as he testified, so all of the demeanor was there. And he was asked questions, first by the counsel who were in Indonesia, and then because Musawi was in that strange hybrid role at that point of being his own attorney but having standby counsel, we allowed Musawi from Virginia to question the witness in Indonesia. And that's how we captured that testimony. It seemed to me that we could have done the same thing with the enemy combatants just as easily, without having to reveal where they were being held, and with the ability with video to cut them off if they said something that was inappropriate or improper. I think technology does enable the current legal system to adjust and adapt to some of the particular challenges that some of these cases might present. To the extent that witnesses are dangerous, volatile, or we need to control exactly what they would say, the Rule 15 very practical approach works with one caveat, and that is obviously if the witness has been beaten to a pulp or if the witness has would try to blurt out things about how he or she has been treated, that would be a problem. Again, however, with editing, that could be edited out if it had to be. So there are ways, I think, with some creative thinking in which these very difficult cases can be tried. And I think, I'll end on this, I think that we need seriously to think about the implications of getting away from the standard criminal justice model for these cases. The problem is we use the label terrorism very broadly these days. You hear about narco-terrorism and cyber-terrorism. And you want to think about a terrorist scenario. Those of you who are movie fans the way I am, if you've seen the latest Die Hard film, which has to do with a cyber attack, which in some respects is potentially more devastating than any bomb, that's very scary. So all of a sudden, are hackers going to be considered terrorists? They could do just as much harm, if not more. So at what point does a criminal act become a terrorist act and therefore go into this secret proceeding? I don't know, but it's scary. And again, as I said before, I think the concept of checks and balances done as much as possible in the open is the way to go. Judge Wald's comment about, you know, being so overcome with fear that we jettison the fundamental principles of our legal and political system is something we absolutely have to remember. You can address the terrorist threat with the tools that we have if the people who are running those tools do their job. The story of September 11, if you read the commission report or the transcripts of my trial, are quite amazing. The number of people on the ground who could see what was happening. That Phoenix memo from the FBI agent, where he began to see a pattern of people of Middle Eastern background with no connection to airlines getting flight training on big jets, was a great piece of old-fashioned criminal investigative work. And why that memo didn't get disseminated throughout the Bureau is one of the great tragedies of September 11th. The flight instructor, not the one from Minneapolis, but there was a woman who testified during the trial who broke down in tears. She was with one of the flight schools in Florida where one of the hijackers had trained. And her gut instinct was, this isn't right. She even called a friend at the FAA and said, hey, is this the way it's done? The guy at the FAA did nothing more with it. She did nothing more. And when she testified at the trial, she cried because she realized had she just pushed a bit further, perhaps that hijacker would have been stopped in his tracks. There's some, I don't even know if his name is in the September 11th report, but the Customs Immigration, probably GS-4 at the Florida airport, who stopped Khatami from entering the United States when Muhammad Atta was there at the airport waiting for him. And many people think Khatami was meant to be the 20th hijacker. That person was just doing the job he or she is supposed to do, and by doing the job, probably kept the fourth plane from getting to its target. The agents out of the Minneapolis field office, who, when they arrested Lasalle, based again on a tip from a civilian who just followed his instincts, their pleas for the FBI to respond are just harrowing and so frustrating. If people had been doing their job, September 11th might still have happened. Hindsight, of course, is brilliant sight. But the point is, we have now, and we had then, mechanisms in place that can address the issue. Part of it is the manpower. You need people who are really committed to the cause, not to political benefit, not to protecting the bureaucracy, but to protecting the people. And if the people who are charged with these jobs would do their job, I don't think we would have to worry as much as we do. The last word I want to mention to you, because I think it's rather telling, is that although, as again, the press has sometimes said that the Lasalle case was a circus, and people said it was a very difficult case. It was a challenging case. I don't know if it was my most difficult. I think probably some of my patent cases were more challenging. But the great irony of the Lasalle case was that about 3 or 4 days after the jury verdict came in, and as you know, the verdict was not for the death penalty, Lasalle filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea. And I end my formal comments with some paragraphs from his motion. Lasalle wrote, and this is paragraphs 16 through 18 of the motion, I was extremely surprised when the jury did not return a verdict of death because I knew that it was the intention of the American justice system to put me to death. I had thought that I would be sentenced to death based on the emotions and anger toward me for the deaths of September 11th. But after reviewing the jury verdict and reading how the jurors set aside their emotions in disgust for me, and focused on the law and the evidence that was presented during the trial, I came to understand that the jury process was more complex than I assumed. Because I now see that it is possible that I can receive a fair trial even with Americans as jurors, and that I can have the opportunity to prove that I did not have any knowledge of and was not a member of the plot to hijack planes and crash them into buildings on September 11, 2001, I wish to withdraw my guilty plea and ask the court for a new trial to prove my innocence of the September 11 plot. Those are the words of Mr. Lasalle. So, I think we have a few minutes for questions. I would be glad to answer them if I can. Let's see. Yes, sir.
In your setting there, the question once we find out now that there were these hidden videotapes that were destroyed, and the evidence from those high-value people probably came from torture, then we have Mr. Musawi's plea. So what troubles you about what appears to be a certain amount of government lawlessness with regards to a case like that?
Because there is a, I don't mean to cop out, there's a pending motion before the Fourth Circuit to remand the appeal for that very issue. I can't address that. Yes.
Hi, I'm Steve Blatt from American. I think I want to preface my comment by saying I think I basically share your thoughts, but I want to play devil's advocate for a second. One of the more common arguments for why we need something different isn't necessarily so much any of the individual substantive rules or the individual substantive issues in individual trials, but the scale of the problem, right? And that it's not that there's one Musawi trial, it's that there would have to be dozens and dozens and dozens of trials of dozens and dozens of defendants. I guess, right, is Judge Mukasey, in one of his op-eds before he was confirmed to be Attorney General, suggested that his experience in the Rockwell trial was exactly that. He thought the system worked, but he would never, ever want to do it again. I wonder if you have any comments on
that. I have to say, I would do it tomorrow. All right? Because it's I like logistics. Frankly, I wish I'd never had to try the case. I wish we weren't here doing this discussion. I can just say how I did it, and I had phenomenal help from the administrative office for the courts. I kept a third law clerk. I went to the Fourth Circuit and said, you know, I need to be able to maintain. I maintained my docket through the entire Musawi case until it went to trial. So I had the paintball case, I had the Farris case, I had some patent cases. You can do it if you know how to manage yourself. One of the things is I got the resources. Having a third law clerk who did nothing but work the Musawi case meant I had continuity of thought. I didn't have to stop and start, and that was invaluable. So again, there are relatively simple, and that was cheap, simple and cheap things that can be done to enable judges to handle that kind of workload. And again, if you look at some of the cases here in the District of Columbia, some of those gang cases that last 8-10 months now. The other thing is, of course, I'm from the Rocket Docket. We do things lean and mean. I have learned over the years how to cut corners that perhaps some courts don't. So, I mean, we don't have 3 days of cross-examination, all right? And so, to some degree as well, if judges are able to know where to cut, you can more effectively and efficiently handle these cases. I don't think the volume in any respect is a respectable argument. And my courthouse never closed. One of the things we worked on was the ability for my colleagues to continue to try their cases. There was some inconvenience to lawyers. People have to wait outside longer to get in. But again, those are logistical issues that can be addressed. Okay?
Judge Franklin, with John Dollinger from the State Department. I'd like to take you back to your initial comments and what you said in general, that you think the criminal system is capable, maybe with some changes, and should, maybe with some changes. And you know where I'm headed. I'd like to maybe focus you. What are those changes? And in particular, I think you heard some of the concerns that I raised this morning, which were less on classified information confrontation, but more some of the problems were, frankly, the initial pickup. Musawi, of course, was someone inside the United States. How do we address the problems with someone where evidence is abroad, witnesses are abroad? It may take you a very long time to build the case, speedy trial, those sorts of things.
Well, I think there are two different things to be thinking about. One is using the legal system and legal process proactively, that is, we're trying to prevent crime from happening by conducting investigations, and then reactively, that is, someone's been caught, now we're going to prosecute them, all right? In organized crime investigations, and I have some experience with that because Bob Blakey was my professor at Cornell and I worked on his Organized Crime Institute for a couple of years, you would often develop an organized crime case for years, sometimes arresting people and letting them out to work as snitches. Again, there are models in complex, long-term criminal investigations for doing the very thing you're talking about, where you postpone the reactive legal process, that is, the trial, which has its more rigid rules, and work in that more proactive, investigated stage. Now, there are rules that we in the criminal justice system would require. You can't use torture. Okay? That's simple. That's law enforcement 101. And, you know, this torture argument is so problematic. A fundamental concept in our legal system, and it ought to be throughout our political system as well, is that coerced information is inherently unreliable. The psychologists will tell you that an awful lot of coerced confessions are just plain false. You can't rely on good intelligence coming from coercion. And frankly, again, and I only speak from the experience I've had with terrorists, a lot of these people will talk if you talk to them as human beings. Musawi, I am convinced if someone had sat down with some tea and been patient and put up with his rambling, you could have gotten information from him because he couldn't keep his mouth shut. Now, I'm not saying that all of these men are that same way, but some of them are. Also, some of these people act out of, and it's hard for us in the West to understand it, deeply held religious viewpoints. I myself cannot, and I don't know if any of you can, I can't conceive of believing in something so intensely that I would consciously today make the decision that I'm going to blow myself up for that cause. Even Americans who run into the battlefield knowing that the odds are against them, there still is that hope I might get through it. But the concept of suicide bombers, of the kamikaze model, is so alien to our value system. We need to try to understand what makes people operate at that level of fanaticism, because I think without understanding it, we're not going to be able to get at the root causes that get people to go to that point anyway. So I understand there is good interrogation technique, some of which can be tough, but they're not torture. But we have to develop ways of getting this information. And again, we also have technology, which is very effective. If the people who are using it are doing their jobs, if they're really listening, if they're doing what any good investigator does, which is putting the pieces together. So I really don't think we need to jettison a system that has worked for us so well for these many years of our existence as a republic, and clearly we shouldn't jettison the values that make us unique. Otherwise, we become like them. We've lost the war. We've absolutely lost the war if we give up those values.
Yeah. We have time, I think, for a couple more questions, although we're running late. I hope everyone will cooperate by moving fast after this ends. Right over there.
Well, I mean, if a judge isn't following the law, he or she should either be prosecuted or impeached. We follow the law. Now, I mean, we have different approaches to it. The point is, judges are not rubber stamps. Again, checks and balances. We're supposed to be balancing the other two systems. The concept of a national security court, in my view, should send shivers up the spine of everybody. It would be an unaccountable court to the American public. And it, to me, would be rank with problems. Having an entrenched defense bar, the reality is it would be almost impossible for those lawyers after a while not to be co-opted into the system. The beauty of our crazy system of government and law is that there is a certain chaotic nature to it. That's what gives it the energy. And I think the scary part about a national security court would be it would become static. And stasis is something I think we need to avoid.
Judge Brinkman, no. I think I'd only be in favor of a national security court if you were the judge.
No.
Thank you very much, Judge Brinkman. I'm going to give you all 5 minutes to eat your dessert, and Judge Brinkham 5 minutes to eat her whole dinner, her whole lunch. Let's resume in room 603 at 1:15, which is 15 minutes from now. So you have a few minutes to finish your dessert and coffee, and then we'll have a brief break, but we'll start at 1:15 promptly.